Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Adam Kempinar.
Dr. Kempinar, my name is Josh Larson. May I speak with you?
You're one of Roger Ebert's, aren't you?
I am, yes.
May I see your credentials?
Certainly.
That Chicago Film Critics Association card expires next week. You're not a real film critic, are you?
I'll let my top five films of 1991 speak for themselves.
Am I dating myself if I go for a Hudson Hawk joke here?
Yes.
Okay, moving on. We return to our year-by-year countdowns with our top five films of 1991, along with a Sacred Cow review of Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho, also from 1991, plus some quick thoughts on the new Spider-Man movie, Shakespeare, and more.
Are those fava beans, Adam?
Ahead on Film Spotting. This episode of Film Spotting is brought to you by Film Spotting listeners, including Dana in Calgary, Alberta, $5 a month subscriber Tony in Sudbury, Ontario, and platinum level donor Matt Heil in New York, New York.
Matt writes, just wanted to say hello and make a long overdue donation. For some reason, I still pay monthly fees to Netflix and Hulu, although I have not watched anything on them in months, and yet I listen to your show weekly and often go through the catalog to hear an episode of a movie I just watched. Example, today, Pacific Rim. I agree with you, Adam. Good fun.
Well done.
And yet, I don't give you guys a dime. Everyone can and should give more to enable you all to do the great work you do.
Thanks, Matt. Also got these nice comments from Dana. It has been a few years since making a donation. Figured it was time to contribute again. Thank you for this show. I love to leave it for a few months, then marathon it. If I listen week to week, I just get too depressed having to wait for a new one. We do hear that over the years. We've heard that from time to time from people who say, I listened to 400 episodes in a row. I had them all just back to back to back. And then what happens when you get caught up? So thank you, Dana. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Tony. And thanks to all of our supporters, whether you make a donation or try out one of our sponsors or just rate us on iTunes, it all helps. For more information about how to support the show, visit filmspotting.net and click on donate. You're listening to Film Spotting, the show where, even though there was huge casting news today about the upcoming Star Wars movie, we're focusing on films more than two decades old.
Yeah, why not?
I figure that's what either makes us ingratiating or infuriating.
Do you want to talk Star Wars for an hour and a half? I probably could.
Speaking of, you'd be up for that. Infuriating. We could go down that path. The highest grossing movie 23 years ago this weekend was the film that would go on to win the Best Picture Oscar, the one I was doing a terrible Hannibal Lecter imitation of in our billboard there, Jonathan Demme's Silence of the Lambs. Number three that weekend at the box office, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 2. The Secret of the Ooze.
Ouch.
One of those films has a shot at making our top five films of 91, which we'll get to later in the show.
So which turtle were you? Donatello? Michelangelo?
I'm going to go with whoever was the bossiest.
Before we get to that top five, our tribute to Shakespeare's recent 450th birthday is a review of a 1991 film that's a somewhat oblique Shakespeare adaptation. Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho.
Hey, Mikey. How long have I been here on this street, on this crusade? Oh, well, I came back to town around 3.5 years ago, and that's when I met you, so it's been 3 years, Mike.
Yeah, almost 4 years. That's a long time.
What I'm getting at, Mike, is that we're still alive.
Yeah, well, that's obvious, isn't it?
Yeah, it's incredibly obvious. They could drop a big old bomb in this city, you know what we would do?
Take shelter.
Sacred Cow time, Adam, where we get a chance to revisit, or in my case here, consider for the first time, an older film on which there's developed a glowing critical consensus. Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho, in which River Phoenix and Keanu Reeves play a pair of runaway teen hustlers working the streets of the Pacific Northwest, is considered a key work, not only in Van Sant's career, but also for its significance in the 1990s indie film landscape and that of gay cinema. We partly chose to review it, however, because of its Shakespeare connection. In the case of Keanu Reeves' character in particular, who's the son of Portland's mayor and has rejected his life of privilege to live on the streets, there are echoes of Henry IV, parts 1 and 2. Reeves Scott is a stand-in for Prince Hal, the wayward monarch-in-waiting. To emphasize this connection, My Own Private Idaho occasionally even slips into scenes in which the actors perform dialogue directly from the original Shakespeare. I've been thinking about this in terms of our ongoing debate over how we should approach movie adaptations of literature. You're much more of the opinion that we shouldn't read the book first, while in most cases, especially those of important literary works, I'd prefer to read it beforehand. I wonder, though, how this might apply to Shakespeare, especially for someone like you who I know is a student of the Bard's work. Would you say an understanding of Henry IV is crucial to appreciating My Own Private Idaho? Or does the movie work on its own terms in that vacuum, free of its source material, that you personally usually prefer?
Well, you're right. We certainly have debated this quite a bit here on the show over the past couple of years, and it's a personal choice, surely, though I do think that reading the source material in any case undoubtedly shades your reaction and your review even more than reading a bunch of interviews would or a bunch of reviews would ahead of time. And those are things that both of us, and I know many critics, though not all, do try to avoid. So that is my personal approach. That said, I suppose I'm less inclined to be hardline about it when the movies are clearly loose adaptations, as this one is. If you've read Romeo and Juliet, for example, I don't think that's ultimately going to affect much your experience with a movie like West Side Story. And being familiar with Henry IV isn't really going to, I think, allow you to get or enjoy My Own Private Idaho anymore. I do think it stands absolutely on its own, separate from the source material. But I probably do, Josh, appreciate it just a little bit more because of my love for those plays. Henry IV, Parts 1 and 2, and Henry V are actually my favorite Shakespeare plays. So there's a little thrill for me when Keanu, for example, has his audience aside in the alley. He turns away from Bob, who very clearly, if you know those plays, is a stand-in for Falstaff, and the camera is just off to the side in a close-up, and he expresses how he's going to impress his family and their friends so much more when he decides to turn good versus if he had just been good all along. And I, being a Shakespeare fan, being a fan of those plays, know that has a direct correlation to Shakespeare, to Henry IV, Part 1. The lines there of Prince Hal, "By how much better than my word I am, by so much shall I falsify men's hopes, and like bright metal on a sullen ground, my reformation, glittering o'er my fault, shall show more goodly and attract more eyes." So I right away go to that text, which I love, and yeah, maybe that does give me a little extra juice to enjoy My Own Private Idaho. That's there, but in thinking about this, I love those plays because there's something obviously about the subject matter and the characters that appeals to me. That identity crisis at its core, the drama of these opposing dialectics, the father-son conflict. So even if My Own Private Idaho didn't explicitly have some basis in Shakespeare, it would still probably be a film about those identity crises, about family conflicts, about those opposing dialectics. And it would still most notably have Gus Van Sant's aesthetic approach, which means it likely still would be a film I loved.
Yeah, and it's not an entirely fair question. I don't know that I could answer it myself, the one I posed to you, because I am familiar with the plays as well. And having read them, I'm bringing that to this viewing experience. So for me, I appreciated those allusions as homages. Mm-hmm. And when it takes that drastic turn, it's probably about 20 minutes in this derelict empty hotel, and suddenly we do get a full probably 10 minutes or so directly from the Shakespeare play, I can enjoy it on those terms. So it is hard for me to separate that as well. I have to imagine those elements might have been even more jarring if I had no familiarity with the Shakespeare. But even bringing it to it and appreciating it on that level, I have to say, I don't think it added to this film for me to be that explicit in it. And maybe if it had been that explicit throughout from the beginning, then with this setting, this contemporary setting, then I would have been okay with it. But people seem to fall a couple ways on how Van Sant uses Shakespeare here, in that it elevates the movie to another degree or it kind of detracts from it. And I have to say, I'm in the camp where it does detract from it, because I was really engrossed in what sort of film this was at the beginning. You know what surprised me? How slyly funny it was.
Oh, yeah.
I think Vincent has, I don't know if he's lost that over the years or chosen to go in a different direction, but very strong sense of humor here that's kind of playing around the edges, though, not in your face. I liked that. I liked the focus on Mike, the River Phoenix character.
Right.
This story of a kid who's run away from home and suffers from narcolepsy. So he's chosen this life on the streets, a very dangerous life. And when things get stressful for him, he passes out. And even the Keanu Reeves character says at one point, I'm surprised he can exist like this, while he's looking over him passed out on a street. And I was so engrossed by that, that once it made that shift into the Shakespeare, for me, it put a wall up. It put a distance between myself and these characters, because one of the strongest things Vincent brings to it, I think, is this idea that the camera is there with them,
mm-hmm.
huddling next to them when they're cold on the streets, when they're joking around and enjoying each other's company, laughing along with them. And that we're forced to take a step back from that when the Shakespeare comes in, and it becomes something more of an acting exercise or a dramatic experiment to me, that really just doesn't add anything to the film. And I think it undercuts, particularly in one way, and maybe here's where we can get to the performances. I think Reeves is pretty good with the Shakespeare, actually.
He's better here than he is in Much Ado, from what I've seen, anyway.
Yeah, I think I was really surprised. Reeves, I mean, he's so confident in this film. I think this might be one of the most confident performances of his career.
Yeah,
even though
he plays
early
the character
on.
That way. He is that way.
And it really
natural.
Works well. But Phoenix, I think, is really, it's a disservice to him and what he's created in this character to suddenly expect him to be able to play this other game that's going on as well, because I don't think he's as equipped. And he was such an arresting presence in the first 15 minutes of the film. He became the heart and soul. I loved this character, this kid who's, you know, become a vagabond and corrupted in some ways, but in other ways is this pure innocent, especially when he falls mm-hmm. asleep. And then when the Shakespeare is thrown at him, he's out of place, and we lose all of that a little bit.
What trick, what device can you find to hide from this open and apparent shame?
Yes. What new trick do you have for us now, Bob?
I definitely agree with you that he's an arresting presence throughout this film, and that it probably is a disservice to him to give him some of those lines, and maybe he isn't as comfortable in the scenes you're describing. But at the same time, this really is Shakespeare that's been bastardized. It isn't as if it really lifts more than maybe a couple lines from the play. So in Mikey's case, the case of the River Phoenix character, I don't recall him really having to spend a whole lot of time getting out those Shakespearean words. But this is his story more than it is Scott's story, more than the Keanu Reeves character. And so that's where it really does differ in a great way from Henry IV parts one
sure,
and two, which
yes.
are, from the name, it tells you they are about that character. For me, the way Shakespeare is integrated really worked. For the same reason, to start with, it works in Shakespeare, which is as comic relief. You talked about the humor. There's already some there, surely, and we get it in other instances and other scenes as well. It's not the primary source of humor, but it is a major one. And I enjoy Bob, that Falstaff character played by William Reichert. I enjoy his bluster and absurdity. And I like the intimacy of those scenes. They're not the same kind of intimacy you get on the street, but you get a different type where there's just that familiarity among those characters, and they can talk to each other and move with each other in a way that only people who go way back and have seen things, as the Flea character talks about, oh, we've seen things. There's a complicated dynamic, too, between the Bob character and Scott that I like. So those scenes really work for me, but the biggest reason I liked it, Josh, is because it's a piece of this larger artistic amalgam that Van Sant has concocted here. And watching this movie again for the first time, not since 91, I probably didn't see it in 91. I think I saw it a few years later when I was in college. I had forgotten just how many styles and approaches were at play here in this film in a really invigorating way. You get elements certainly of a road movie. It opens on that famous road shot. You get elements of a Western. There's a key scene, right, where you have two men sitting around a campfire out in the desert talking with each other. They get a little Brokeback on screen long before Ang Lee ever brought it to the big screen. There's elements of a documentary here. Some of my favorite scenes are these scenes where you get a couple street hustlers describing for the camera their first experience turning tricks. That could be an entirely separate film.
Yeah, those
just
are
about
great
Portland
scenes.
Street kids. There's those great tableau sex montages. Rather than seeing people have sex, we just get these still shots of bodies in various states and poses. That magazine scene you talked about that's really funny, where Keanu and River Phoenix and other characters are on the cover of men's magazines, adult magazines, and they come to life and talk directly to us. I love that. And we can go on and on. There's home movie footage, dream sequences, shots of nature. There's an iris shot at one point, a couple points, I think, actually, on the road showing that messed up face that River Phoenix's character talks about. There's musical numbers, and there's scenes where there's dialogue that's clearly improvised, and they're kind of just winging it. And you mix all of that with Shakespeare, with this gang of drunks and thieves that seems like it came off a Portland stage instead of the Portland streets. So I think that Van Zandt, he combines all of these formal elements in a way that feels vital without it ever seeming to me forced or unformed, but it still reflects a filmmaker who is clearly trying to define his style, trying to define himself, just as his characters are experimenting and trying to define themselves.
I'll sell my ass. Do it on the street occasionally for cash. Or I'll be on the cover of a book. It's when you start doing things for free that you start to grow wings. Isn't that right, Mike?
What?
Wings, Michael. You grow wings and become a fairy.
What do you care about money? You got plenty of money. Why don't you just go ahead and do whatever it is that you do? You can only imagine what that is for free.
Is that right, sweetie?
So how much is a lot of money, honey?
So what are you doing on the cover of that magazine, Slummy?
Actually, Mike is right. I am going to inherit money. A lot of money.
You're absolutely right that there's this great mix of styles going there. I guess for me, the Shakespeare is probably the one that might stick out like a sore thumb. We could also talk about elements of magical realism that he brings to it, which I thought was really fun. The porn magazine covers maybe is a part of that, but also this shot, it may be recurring or maybe it's only once early on, of an old barn falling from the sky and just crashing on
the highway. I love that image. Makes me think of Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, it's an amazing image. And again, I don't know if I'm forgetting things that Van Zandt has done in recent years, but it just seemed so a different sort of eye than what he's had lately. And it was so refreshing and really cool to see. And I just love that scene you talked about where they're talking to the street kids about their first tricks and those experiences is really amazing. And it's directly to the camera. And I found myself wondering, who are they talking to? Because the way it's framed, it's in this coffee shop where they hang out. Mm-hmm. And they go back and forth. It's not like one kid shares his story and another kid shares his story. They're kind of intercut. And after a while, I was just wondering, who's listening to these kids?
Right.
And maybe no one is. It's almost as if they're all talking over each other. And there's this real overall empathy that exudes from this movie for these kids that I found so affecting and very distinctive from something like maybe Harmony Korine would depict a similar subculture in a sense that the priority here, which I sometimes feel from him, the priority is to shock and to get the audience to kind of jump back and, whoa, I can't believe these kids are talking this way or about this or doing this. And here it was more the kids themselves who were the priority and their experiences and their story. And so I really liked that. That scene is probably the key example of it. But I think you can detect it in almost every scene that involves some of those kids. Mm-hmm. And I guess for me, that's another thing that gets a little bit lost when it does jump to Shakespeare, even when it's handled well. I have a feeling that Reichert would be just amazing on the stage doing Shakespeare. You can tell he's clearly the most equipped in this cast, right, to handle this material. But there's something about, I feel like there's almost a disservice being done to the character of Falstaff in a way with how he's used here and incorporated in this other story that the movie mainly wants to tell. So it's a reference and maybe a misuse. He stands out at the same time. There's something bothersome about that character where even though I could tell he was very good at it, it didn't quite work for my own Private Idaho.
Scotty, when you inherit your fortune on your 21st birthday, let's see. How far away is this?
1 week away, Bob. Just one more week.
Let's not call ourselves robbers. But Diana's foresters. Gentlemen of the shade. Minions of the moon. Men of good government.
You're listening to Film Spotting. We're discussing Gus Van Sant's third film, his third feature, My Own Private Idaho from 1991. It's one of our sacred cow discussions. And obviously, we disagree on this point about how the Shakespeare is used. You mentioned a disservice to Falstaff, and let's be clear. Falstaff has no honor, so Gus Van Sant could do whatever he wants with that character. But I think the other thing the use of Shakespeare in this film highlights for me is this notion that these kids on the street, that this sort of existence that he clearly wants to explore, Van Sant as a filmmaker, that these struggles are timeless. Mm-hmm. It puts it in this much larger artistic context. They've always existed. They will always exist. So I like that. And then I mentioned a little while back this notion of opposing dialectics. That is the heart of Henry IV. Everybody wants me to behave this way. Mm-hmm. I'm going to behave this way. Forget my royal obligations. I'm going to go have fun in the pub. And Falstaff and Bob, they represent that life, that alternative to his father, the king, in this case, the mayor. And I think as well, it's only fitting that Bob's world, this alternative world, would have its own language, its own rituals almost, in contrast to that royalty. But this film, for me, is really all about those oppositional dialectics. And I really, at this point, hope I'm using that phrase properly, Josh, because that was the other thing, in addition to the style, that really jumped out to me, is it's not just the notion of Bob's world versus my father's world, the street versus politics, if you will, and fortune. But we get, of course, in the Mikey character, River Phoenix is searching for his mother. He's searching for a sense of home, in contrast to a character like Scott, who has a home and is running away from it and is running away from his father. So you've got the father versus mother. There's really something going on as well with this notion, I think, of private and public spaces in the film. The dialectic of sleeping with men only for money, which Scott does, versus doing it for money, but also maybe because you have other feelings for men, as we see with Mikey. And I mentioned this idea of one character being completely abandoned by his family, where the other one is running away from his family, going home versus leaving your home. So those are all at play. But the other one, the key one for me, and this gets back to Henry IV, and I guess why I'm glad it's a key part of this film, is this idea of living life, embracing who you are versus closing yourself off from the world and denying who you are. And that all comes to play. It all comes to bear at the end of this movie, in the closing scenes, where you've got two men dead, two fathers to Scott, one the surrogate father in Bob, two funerals going on at the exact same time, but two vastly different types of ceremonies, right? One with howling and expressions of joy, but also sadness and emotion. This idea of life that Mike, we see River Phoenix kind of choose at one point. He looks over at Scott and he makes a decision. We see it in his eyes to howl, to yell and mm-hmm. say, I'm going to embrace this type of life versus the coldness and the austerity of Scott and that funeral procession, which makes me think a little more of this idea that he's dead in some ways inside and by choosing to forsake that other type of life. So you take away Bob, and you take away that language and the richness of that, for me, you kind of lose the core of the movie. So I guess that, for me, really is so integral.
That howl that you mentioned, it's one of those examples. This is just a fascinating performance for me by Phoenix. And I know it's not necessarily a first or second one from him. He had done a lot of work before this, but you do feel like maybe this is a chance where he had to experiment a little bit and push himself and go in some other directions. Sometimes it works. Mostly it works, I think. Sometimes it doesn't. The Shakespeare scenes are the impulsive ones. And that howl is an interesting mix of the two.
Yeah.
Because you could see there's almost a pause there where he's thinking, is that what I should do here? Okay, I'm going to do it. The others are all going crazy around him. It's very improvisational. And part of that plays into the character, as you're talking about, too. So yeah, I do think it works. But wow, just overall, he's an unexpected, unpredictable presence in this mm-hmm. movie. He's jittery, but trying to exude this sense of confidence and comfort on the streets. He's like somebody, you know, at a party who really doesn't want to be there, but's trying to convince themselves that they're having a great time. And I'm just curious to hear what you thought of Phoenix's presence here, because he's someone who, you know, we kind of have in Hollywood lore, thinking of this actor we lost young. And this being the first time I had seen the movie, mm-hmm. I was just shocked by what a talent he really was.
Yeah, that's interesting, because I remember him, of course, from Stand By Me and a few other films, mainly as a much younger kid. And here, this is a true grown-up performance. And you wonder sometimes whether or not he's revered. And he's overly revered because he passed away too soon. And a lot of people are thinking, well, what could have been? And maybe we over-romanticize how good he was as an actor. I don't know whether or not there's really any truth to that, in the sense that I'd love to hear some people who have really studied his work and really thought about that provide their perspective. But all I can say, based on rewatching My Own Private Idaho, is that I don't think we probably are over-romanticizing how good he is, because it's the same way we and many others of a different generation romanticize actors like Brando, a young Brando, a young James Dean. He has that same kind of unpredictable, as you put it, presence on screen. He's very physical, but never manic. He's never gesticulating just for the hell of it. Mm-hmm. It's always really controlled. But there is this sense of someone who sort of wants to break all the rules of acting. He's not going to abide by any standard that anyone has set forth before him. And he just has this presence and devotion to character on screen. And I love those little moments. I mentioned the howl, but there are a lot of others where he just sort of looks away for a moment and you almost wonder if he thinks that the camera has stopped rolling or it doesn't matter. It's as if the camera doesn't even matter to him. He isn't performing for the camera, right? That scene we talked about, the campfire scene, where he has his great, really heartbreaking line about how I really want to kiss you. He mumbles it in a way that it's the key line of the film. A lot of actors may have decided to pronounce that and really try to showcase the emotion and make that line stand out. Instead, he takes the key line of the film and almost deliberately tries to make it hard for us to understand him. I love touches like that.
I only have sex with a guy for money.
Yeah, I know.
And two guys can't love each other.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I mean, for me, I could love someone even if I, you know, wasn't paid for it. I love you and don't pay me.
Mike.
I really want to kiss you, man.
Now, Reeves, I don't think is working in quite the same way, or probably at the same level, but I really do think
he's
quite good here. And it's not only just the confidence I talked about, but there's you can see he probably has the star charisma that he'll go on to develop, which maybe Phoenix does, maybe Phoenix doesn't. And we don't quite know yet. He certainly has the potential for it, but you can see it right there in Reeves already, just knowing how the camera's going to gravitate to him and he's going to be able to hold it. And I think he handles some key lines as well in the film pretty perfectly. There's that great one where the two of them are riding on the bike, and the conversations with Mikey are always fascinating because you don't know if he's listening. He's kind of asked to ask to be repeated the question.
Right.
And they're talking about how long they've known each other and lived on the streets. And Reeves is just in kind of this airy dreamland pontificating. He just says, what I'm getting at, Mike, is we're still alive.
Right.
And there's just something really poetic and life-affirming in a way about that moment, even though it's not necessarily because they're in a good situation or headed anywhere good. And that brings me, you know, to the film's ending, because what I wasn't prepared for.
I'm glad you're going here. Yeah.
I don't know how much we want to get into it, even though it's a 1991 film, is how we're left.
How do you read it? Yeah.
How did I read it? Pretty rough.
Did you?
Yeah, I did. I mean, and again, maybe it's just because of that attachment that I had for Mikey from the beginning, and those being the key moments of the film for me, the ones I responded to the most.
Right.
And just seeing after all of this and coming to know him and what his options are and aren't and where he is, I think of him being asleep again without Reeves standing over him saying, I don't know how he can survive.
No, that's a really good point. He doesn't have the Scott character there to look out for him, which he has throughout the film. And we're not maybe going to discuss it explicitly, but at the end of the film, not that plot really matters here in this type of film, and it doesn't, but to dance around it a little bit, there is a moment at the end of the film where we see Mike's character in his usual position, and then he is confronted by, in that sleepy state, by two different individuals.
Yeah.
And the first one, it's definitely something we could describe in very basic terms as bad.
Mm-hmm.
They do something to him that's not good, not good for Mike. The second one, we're not totally
sure.
It's
ambiguous.
It's ambiguous. And I think you described very well why you are pessimistic, that it's also bad. But I guess since I read the film as all about these opposing dialectics, for me, I wonder if it's Gus Van Sant imposing that yet again, and it's the bad and the good. And we're supposed to see the good, because you talked about it. There's a poetry to this film and a sense of empathy and being life-affirming that does cover up the fact that you're right. It's pretty bleak at times. There isn't a lot of hope with these characters, and a lot of bad things do happen to these characters as the movie goes on. But because of those other characteristics, it makes it an enjoyable watch, truly an enjoyable watch. And I do just want to add about the Keanu Reeves character, something that I found interesting in relation to Henry IV is that maybe what works so well about Reeves's performance is that he not only portrays his kind of vanity and his pride and his confidence, but it's really about not judging the character. He clearly accepts that there's a certain vileness to Scott, even with some of his other good characteristics. He does help his friend Mikey, but he accepts the fact that he is ultimately selfishly motivated. And what's different about him versus Hal is that if you think about the plays, Prince Hal, his predetermined life is one not just of wealth and power, but one of responsibility. He has to ascend to the throne at some point. He has to serve the people of England. Scott, when he finally embraces his predetermined life, all he's doing is getting rich and getting powerful and getting more respect. There's no ascension to be the mayor of Portland. There's a suggestion that maybe he could get
some
into
business
politics,
implications,
but there's absolutely no service. There's no larger responsibility. And so we can discuss how likable a character Prince Hal is, and even how likable a character he is as a king in Henry V. But I don't know by the end of My Own Private Idaho that we can really debate that. It's pretty clear that this Scott character is motivated in ways that make him someone that is a pretty bad guy.
Except that he's the only one throughout the film, maybe Mikey, but who expresses honesty. He's honest with everyone he talks to about his motivations.
You're right.
I mean, he's very abrupt with Mike at that campfire scene.
Yeah.
And lays it out flat. He's abrupt with Bob, lays it out flat. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows he's there just because. So there's something to admire about that honesty.
No, there is.
But yeah, he doesn't have that outside burden that Prince Hal might have, which would provide motivation for that turn he takes.
Exactly. And even, you're right, in that campfire scene where he does reject Mike and his advances, he does say, come over, and he comforts him, and he does hug him. So I'm not suggesting that there isn't anything good or positive to his character, but there is a key difference between him and Prince Hal that I think is intriguing. My Own Private Idaho is available as a Criterion Collection DVD. It's also available via digital rental on Amazon, Google Play, and YouTube.
We'll continue the Shakespeare celebration next with Adam's interview with Kevin Rich, Artistic Director of Illinois Shakespeare. And since superheroes are now in season, we'll share some brief thoughts on Captain America and Spider-Man. Stay with us.
If one could stop time and make it up, two could realize the best of luck. If I could locate God above, and you only wanted to be loved, then I'd try.
Bumpers. Life doesn't give you bumpers.
Welcome back to Film Spotting with Adam and Josh. A short clip there from the trailer to the new film from director Richard Linklater. It's called Boyhood. Back in 2002, Linklater cast six-year-old Eller Coltrane, and over the next 12 years shot bits of the film. As Coltrane grew up, the film also stars Ethan Hawke and Patricia Arquette as his mom and dad. It was met with a pretty rapturous response this winter at Sundance, and with the release scheduled for mid-July, it's certainly among our most anticipated films of the summer. Our film spotting poll question this week looks ahead to next week's top five, when we'll count down our most anticipated summer 2014 movies. That's in a bit.
But first, the results of the poll we posed a couple weeks back. Our question was a patented film spotting death match. We pitted Jim Jarmusch against indie director peer John Sayles. We recently reviewed Only Lovers Left Alive, Jarmusch's deadpan meditation on mortality with the impeccably cast Tilda Swinton and Tom Hiddleston as a pair of centuries-old vampires.
We like that Jarmusch-Sayles pairing because both filmmakers made their debuts about the same time, 1979, 1980. They both are, of course, writer-directors, and they both had pretty high-profile careers and work with some big-name talent, but definitely retained their independence from the studio system. So we gave you that death match. Simply, which filmmaker do you prefer? My vote, Josh, did go to John Sayles. Yours went to Jarmusch. But I did confess, I really had no idea how this one was going to come out, other than I thought Jarmusch would win. I just thought maybe it would be fairly close. It turns out I was dead wrong.
It was not fairly close. Sayles received 32% of the vote, with Jarmusch getting 68%.
So there you go, the filmmaker behind such movies as Down by Law, Dead Man, and Ghost Dog, beating out the filmmaker responsible for Mate Juan, Eight Men Out, Lone Star, and others. Ken wrote in, he said, okay, last year it was Whedon versus Abrams. This year it's Jarmusch versus Sayles. Exactly how many hipster film geek marriages and relationships are you guys trying to break up anyway?
Sorry about that, Ken. Andy H. from Melbourne, Australia said, such a close call. Both filmmakers have excellent efforts to their name, but I have to go with Sayles. Never less than honest and true to his characters, unafraid of the small story and always enthralled to it, Sayles is the voice for the downtrodden and the little man. He's almost a guiding spirit to the Golden Brick Awards. Jarmusch is redolent with style, a force that sometimes overwhelms the substance of his stories. It's this style that will win this poll for him, though. It's hard to resist.
I guess it was. Joshua from Portland, Oregon says, ever since I saw Down by Law as an 18-year-old budding film lover, Jim Jarmusch has been working his way into the top spot of my favorite directors. I truly think he is the best independent mind working in cinema in the last 30 years, even while keeping his distinct aesthetic within each film. None are derivative of another. Finally, as my last trump card in the ultimate fanboy competition, I have a tattoo on my forearm of Eva's cassette player from Stranger Than Paradise. Wow. Commemorating one of my personal five favorite films of all time.
That is a commitment.
Maybe
we should do that for our top five list to really solidify our commitment. We could get them tattooed somewhere. Probably run out of space after a couple shows.
But I want to hear from film spotting listeners, though. At the very least, it will make for some great bonus content on our app. If you've got a movie-related tattoo, send it in. feedback@filmspotting.net.
And where on your body is it?
Yeah, we also need photos or it didn't happen.
From Will Glass. Will said, OMG, this isn't even close. While I appreciate the quirkiness of Jarmusch, Sayles films of the 1980s and 90s are brilliant in their exploration of various facets of American society. The political messages of those films were needed in Reagan's America. The films weren't blunt political tracks, but told powerful stories peopled with engaging, sympathetic characters. Mate Juan may be the best of these. I've shown it several times to students in my classes, and my students never fail to connect with the story of Joe Kenahan and his efforts to build a union among coal miners. Most of my students were fairly conservative Southerners, but they grudgingly came to side with miners. The best comment I got was from one student who wrote, I don't believe in unions, but those people sure needed one.
Well said. John Nordyke from Corvallis, Oregon, closes us out properly here, I think, Josh. I changed my vote right at the last second and went with John Waters.
No write-in votes in a death match. Come on, John.
True. This isn't Nam. There are rules to these poll questions. Thank you to John and everyone else for your pithy comments and your votes in the poll. That does bring us to this week's poll question, our art house versus mainstream movies death match, if you will. We're looking ahead to the summer of 2014, and we were joking earlier, but really only half joking, about just posing the question, is your most anticipated summer movie Boyhood, the Linklater film, just considering our audience and their tastes, or anything else? And just giving you those two options. And I did post that on Twitter as an alternative question. Small sample size so far, Josh. But right now, if you went by that sample, it'd be about 80-20 Boyhood.
80-20, wow. So, any something else titles come up?
A few that I'm sure we'll get to on that top five next week. But instead, what we're doing is supposing that a time machine comes and takes you to a movie theater midsummer 2014, just a few months off here, so not
a limited
much
time
in the
machine
way of time travel.
Doesn't have a lot of power.
Which double feature do you choose?
Okay. Here's the double features: Richard Linklater's Boyhood and Kelly Reichardt's Night Moves. Reichardt, of course, director of Old Joy, Wendy and Lucy, and Meek's Cut Off. Her latest, Night Moves, stars Jesse Eisenberg, Dakota Fanning, and Peter Sarsgaard as environmentalists plotting to blow up a dam. All right, the blockbuster pairing here, double feature: 22 Jump Street and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes.
Wow. This is a good question.
It's a very good question. It's difficult for me because if I were to assign a value to each of these movies. I'm going to try to turn this into math because I love math so much. But it helps me think through this. Dawn of the Planet of the Apes might get the highest value. It might be the one I'm most looking forward to out of all of these, believe it or not. But if you add up the values of Boyhood and Night Moves, they trump Dawn of the Planet of the Apes. 22 Drum Street, I mean, I thought the first one was amusing, but I don't really need another one.
You don't need one?
Not really.
You don't need those guys going to college, Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill? Come on.
I'd probably be okay.
Well, for me, I agree. It's very tough because I'm looking forward to all four of these movies, but in contrast to you, if I was going to give them all a rating, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes would probably be last for me.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I
know you liked the other one.
I did like Rise of the Planet of the Apes, but I'm just that excited about Boyhood and Night Moves. So that's definitely the winner for me. An earlier version of this question, actually, our producer, Sam, had envisioned it as a drive-in double feature, which really, of course, changes the answer, I think, right? If you consider the location
you're
seeing
the movies.
We have
to think about venue as well,
because if you think about the venue, then there's no doubt I'm going Jump Street and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes to watch at a drive-in.
It's true.
I'm not going to go art house there. So we just changed it to a movie theater. We want to know what you think. You can vote now at filmspotting.net.
We're in trouble. Who's that guy?
It was an accident in the genomics lab, and they're covering it up.
That sounds cool. This is the maintenance closet. This is the most cliched hiding place you could have chosen. This is the stupidest hiding place.
Take us to the Bahamas of hiding places.
Listen.
Emma Stone and Andrew Garfield. Speaking of summer movies, we've got The Amazing Spider-Man 2. It opens this weekend. Just going to spend a couple minutes on this here, Josh, as I have not seen the movie yet. And if I'm being totally honest, probably will not get a chance to over the next few months. It's just not going to be a priority for me, though I guess you can now admonish me or tell me that's a good thing, because you have seen The Amazing Spider-Man 2. And do I need to rush out? Make sure I've seen it? No.
I'm at the point I think I'm just going to pretend this iteration of Spider-Man doesn't exist. It's
really
just not doing anything for me. I really liked the Sam Raimi, Tobey Maguire trilogy. And there's just, the first one seemed just to be unnecessary. It wasn't doing anything that new or interesting with the character. And this one is even more so. It's still a franchise in search of an identity. And I think they want that to be the identity of Andrew Garfield, who I think is a really talented young actor who plays Peter Parker in Spider-Man. But he doesn't work here for me. He's overly sort of twitchy and just trying to overdo the cute aspect, the dreamboat aspect of this, which may work for some people. I'm sure others will find him dreamy, but to me, it's working it a little hard. There's a lot of batting of the eyelashes in this performance, and I don't think he's very good at all. And overall, you just can't describe what this movie wants to do with the character. When you think of the really good superhero movies, in my mind, they have a unifying identity to them. You can describe them almost with one word. We'll get to Captain America, the Winter Soldier. What comes to my mind for that film overall is disillusionment. That's what that movie was about and the character grappled with. And that gives it its identity. You go back to the Dark Knight series and everyone describes it as dark. I would say burdened. Those movies felt burdened to me. That's what they wanted to bring to it. Even the Raimi Spider-Man films, to me, all of them had an effervescence to them that gave that trilogy a unifying experience. This one, it just doesn't have anything. Besides the fact that it's 2 hours and 20 minutes with
really
like two or three villains, I lost track, five different plot strands, and at 2:20, it still didn't have enough time to give any of those the attention they deserve.
Well, let's move on to hopefully better superhero movies. Captain America 2, The Winter Soldier, breaking box office records. It's doing great worldwide, which I'm guessing means we're definitely going to get a Captain America 3. And I have seen this one. Listeners, of course, heard Michael Phillips spend a few minutes on it back when it opened here on Film Spotting. He did like the movie, and I'm with Michael, and I'll link to a few comments I had about the movie on Letterboxd. I'll link to that review in the show notes at filmspotting.net, or just go to letterboxd.com/filmspotting and you can find it. But I'm really surprised, and I said this over there at Letterboxd, that of all of these superhero movies and all of these Marvel movies that have come out, it turns out that the two Captain America movies, never in a million years would have guessed that they'd be among my favorite. But I think they are among the best of what I've seen of this franchise, if you want to call it that, of this series so far. And I think a big reason why, first of all, I'm shocked at how dramatic and how disillusioned, as you said, Josh, that Captain America character is, which makes him compelling as a main character. And the directors here, Anthony and Joe Russo, and the screenwriters, Christopher Marcus, Stephen McFeely, they do a really good job. Crazy idea here for a superhero movie. They construct the film largely around relationships. It isn't until the end of the movie that, of course, we have to get the obligatory CGI and the big action set pieces, which I don't appreciate as much, but everything leading up to that is those relationships, and it's also these great old school. I know everyone has talked about how this is kind of a 70s paranoid thriller. I get where they're going with that, though I can't say I felt it that much. But where I did feel it a little bit was in terms of some of the great action sequences that precede the end, where they're old school stunt and chase driven versus computer effects driven. I really respond to that. It makes sense with this character in this Captain America series so far. Again, by the end of the film, with some of those action set pieces, and also this idea, the central conceit of the film is all about freedom versus security and data mining and this stuff that actually I felt like they did something new with, and I was really intrigued by it for a while. By the end of the movie, I realized, oh, this is actually just kind of the Dark Knight trilogy mixed with Mission Impossible and even a little bit of Star Wars. I mean, there's a moment in this film, right, at the end of the movie where one sort of nondescript commanding officer says to one of his people, instead of fire when ready from Star Wars, he says, activate the algorithm. But he says it the same way, even. It's like almost an homage to Star Wars, but it felt like a mishmash of too many other films by the end of it. But it still wasn't enough to make me not appreciate the film overall. What about you?
Yeah, you're right about the end. And I think Michael Phillips talked about that a little bit, too, in that it just gets a little bludgeoning. You know, so many things have to be crashing and exploding and just so much has to be going on. It does lose a little bit there. But otherwise, there are so many things to really like about this movie. And one of them is the development of the Captain America character, who I think is played well by Chris Evans. I mean, one of the great things they've done with these Marvel properties overall are cast them really well. And I think that's one of the reasons we're surprised that we're responding to titles we might not have thought otherwise. I never would have thought I'd be interested in Iron Man or Thor, for goodness sakes. But, you know, I have liked some of those films. So as far as Captain America goes, you know, the surveillance paranoia thing, it's right there in the casting of Robert Redford, actually, right? He's playing the flip side of all the President's men.
Mr. Three Days of the Condor.
And I liked how invested he was in this part. I mean, he gets a good chunk of screen time here, and they make that pass, that homage work, as well as this character that he's playing. There's also some Snowden implication. You know, I love the drone stuff in these, these superhero movies.
This must be a five-star movie.
Some great drone stuff. I like how they target the drones are targeted by basically using our Facebook profiles is essentially what they're doing in this movie, right? So everything we're uploading and giving away free, look out, the drones are coming. But the other thing, you know, this movie has, and it's a theme that's popping up. We'll see if this carries through the rest of the year. But a couple of really good films so far is this idea of nostalgia. The Grand Budapest Hotel, Only Lovers Left Alive. In Captain America, The Winter Soldier, there's a very deep sense of nostalgia for a past where right and wrong isn't necessarily black and white. It doesn't play it that simplistically. Even Captain America himself says, we did some things in World War II we're not proud of. Mm-hmm. But still, he has this sense of that things have only gotten more inextricably linked between good motivations, bad results, and vice versa in this current world that he finds himself in after being awoken. And he doesn't know how to handle that. So he has this nostalgia for the past. And it even comes down to nice touches about how he gets into his original costume, which I really liked. So, yeah, this was – I like the original Captain America as well, and this one probably even more so.
Yeah, I'm with you. I liked it even a little bit more than the first Captain America. Well, we promised a little bit more Shakespeare talk. Let's get to it.
Are not you Signor Benedick?
You know me well. I am he.
Signor, you are very near my brother in his love. He is enamored on Hero. I pray you, dissuade him from her. She is no equal for his birth.
How know you? He loves her.
I heard him swear his affection.
So did I, too. And he swore he would marry her tonight.
Come, let us to the banquet.
Not only a little more Shakespeare talk, but more Keanu Reeves here on Film Spotting. We're all Keanu all the time. After My Own Private Idaho, that was him, of course, as the bad guy, Don John, from Kenneth Branagh's adaptation of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing. You'll understand why we played that clip here in a moment as we get to my quick conversation with Kevin Rich. Kevin is the artistic director at Illinois Shakespeare, which is down in Bloomington Normal, just a couple hours from Chicago. Much more significantly, though, Josh, he is my former college roommate.
That's what he's really famous
for. He puts that actually at the top of CV and on his business cards. He's also, interestingly to Film Spotting listeners, the man who's basically responsible for this show, as he is the social butterfly who back in 2001 decided to introduce me to Sam Van Hallgren, the original Film Spotting co-host, now producer. I was talking with Kevin a few weeks ago on the phone, Josh, you know, as former college roomies are wont to do from time to time, and he was telling me about how excited he was about the upcoming season this summer at Illinois Shakespeare, and I was so fascinated by the concept behind the season that I really thought, regardless of anyone out there listening, whether they have the means to attend an Illinois Shakespeare production this summer, I wanted to share that concept here on the show. So let's go to Kevin outlining that concept, and alas, his answer is not an iambic pentameter.
True rep is becoming increasingly rare in this country, but we still do it down in Bloomington Normal. And I wanted to put together a season that sort of celebrates the fact that we are a repertory company. So we're doing three shows. Two of them are Shakespeare plays, and the third is a newish play. It's premiered, I think, about 10 years ago at the Stratford Festival in Canada, called Elizabeth Rex by Timothy Findlay. And in a nutshell, the main characters of the play are Queen Elizabeth I and William Shakespeare. And it takes place on the night before Queen Elizabeth's lover, Essex, is getting executed for treason. And she has to execute him for political reasons, but personally, she's obviously pretty broken up about it. So the playwright imagines that on the night before the execution, she requires distraction and goes to see a new play by William Shakespeare called Much Ado About Nothing, and afterwards hangs out with Shakespeare and the actors all night long in the hours leading up to the execution. And in the process, befriends Ned Lowenscroft, the actor who played Beatrice earlier that day, because, of course, men played all the parts, mm-hmm. including women. And Ned Lowenscroft played most of the leading ladies. And she struck up a really interesting friendship with him. She says to him at one point in the play, you know, it's interesting, you play a woman for a living and I play a man for a living. I'll teach you how to be more of a man if you teach me how to be more of a woman. And he helps her grieve as a woman the loss of her lover Essex. It's a great story. And meanwhile, Shakespeare is up in the balcony writing another new play called Antony and Cleopatra, that is, at least in the context of Elizabeth Rex, about Elizabeth and Essex. So we are producing that play in rep with Much Ado About Nothing and Antony and Cleopatra, the two plays that are referenced in mm-hmm. Elizabeth Rex. And more than that, the Much Ado About Nothing that we produce will be the Much Ado About Nothing that she saw earlier that day. So the cast will, like all the actors in Elizabeth Rex, will actually play those characters in the Much Ado About Nothing, which means that this will be the first all-male, truly original practices production of a Shakespeare play in the history, in the 37-year history of the Illinois Shakespeare Festival. Wow. And then in Antony Cleopatra, if it's about Queen Elizabeth, then the same actress who plays Queen Elizabeth will also play Cleopatra in Antony and Cleopatra. So there's this sort of thread that ties the three plays together.
So I think what really intrigued me, obviously, is all those connections between the three plays and the way you're using the actors, because I have to guess what attracted you to it was this idea of those connections informing the audience's reaction to all three plays. It's not just about going to one play and having an experience, but reacting to all three of them, but also then the actors themselves having an informed experience based on playing these other characters, then bringing that to the various productions.
Yeah, I really like this idea that these plays can talk to each other, mm-hmm. that having a rep company offers that kind of opportunity. Last summer was my first season as artistic director, and one of the things that we did was that we offered, all of the plays were 2 hours long. We're outside, and it's only getting hotter in central Illinois, so to guarantee two-hour productions on the stage, plus intermission, allowed us to reopen the courtyard after the shows, and so audience and actors would hang out and have a drink, you know, after the show. And what I discovered was that many of our audience come to see one of the shows or even two of the shows, but were surprised to discover that the actors were in all three of them. And when they were able to make personal connections with those actors, they then were invested in a way that they wanted to go back and see more. So I wanted to take it to the next level this year and have some sort of a thematic connection mm-hmm. between the productions.
You mentioned original practices earlier, and many people listening can probably guess how that applies to Shakespeare productions. But for those who maybe aren't so sure, can you explain what that means and why is it something that's so important to you?
Well, that's an interesting point because I wonder, I mean, there could be some misconceptions with this term original practices. I'm really interested in Shakespeare as a populist. Shakespeare was able to appeal to the aristocracy and the working class and everyone in between at the same time and get them all into the theater at once. And that interests me a great deal. And when I, in preparation for this job, I actually took this like Kerouacian 5,000-mile road trip around the country. I went to Shakespeare festivals all over the country and paid as much attention to the audience as I did to the shows themselves. I was curious to know who's coming and what productions are most successful in reaching a wide audience, not just a young audience or an older audience, you know, but getting everybody there at once and appealing to everybody at once. And what I discovered was that the productions that were considering the spirit in which the plays were written or considering the way the plays were designed to be performed were the ones that were most successful in bringing in an audience that would have resembled his original audience. And by that I mean these plays were written for an audience that was in plain view. So the big one is there was actual interaction with the audience. In his indoor stage, you had seats up on the stage. We do the same thing even in our outdoor space. We call them the barred head seats. People can sit up on the stage and they'll actually be, you know, interacted with. Props might be handed, you know, to them, or they'll be spoken, you know, directly to, or laps may be sat, and no one will be dragged up on the stage. But that kind of, I don't know, there's something about that genuine interaction or audience watch the play, which makes the language somehow even more accessible.
That interaction is actually so important to you that it's a reason why you really have no business being on this show. You're not a huge fan, or at least you're not someone who's really passionate about watching Shakespeare on film, are you?
Well, I'm really interested in you coming down to see our stage production of Much Ado and comparing it to either the Branagh or the recent Joss Whedon, mm-hmm. you know, Much Ado, because you're right. The more I'm investigating these original practices and the more I'm understanding how important it is that these characters speak directly with the audience, that there's as much an actor audience relationship as there is character character relationship. I mean, it's built into the plays. The harder it is for me to appreciate the film versions.
You do have an exciting season coming up. Tell our listeners where they can find out more.
Absolutely. Our website is thefestival.org. And this year, I mean, I really am interested in having you down. Thanks for, you know, helping mm-hmm. Put the word out. Now we have an indoor space as a kind of a rain space. What excites me about that is that there's a guarantee of a show, so we can reach out to markets that are within a day's drive, and people can be confident that they can, you know, they can make the 2.5 hour max drive down from Chicago and be guaranteed a show, rain or shine. And because we now have matinees, it's possible to see the entire season with just one overnight. So you can see a Friday night, Saturday matinee, Saturday night show, and then you've seen the whole season.
I look forward to seeing all three of those plays. Kevin, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Adam.
My thanks again to Kevin. Right now, there is a plan in place, Josh, for me to head down to Bloomington Normal, to Illinois Shakespeare this summer, and lead a discussion after the performance of Much Ado About Nothing on Sunday afternoon, July 27th.
So, will you be doing that in iambic pentameter?
Of course.
Good.
Of course. I was an English major. I can do that.
No problem.
So there will be more details about that over the next month or so. We'll certainly share them here on the show and our website, filmspotting.net, and via social media if you follow us at Filmspotting on Twitter. To learn more about the festival in general, that site again is thefestival.org. In our bonus content this week, which you can get if you have the Filmspotting app for iPhone, Android, or Windows 8 phone, we're going to share a little bit of additional audio from my talk with Kevin, get into a little bit of the show history stuff, including how Sam and I met. So,
what your favorite colors are, favorite
pretty
animals.
Much, pretty much. That too. Riveting radio there via the Film Spotting app. We'll also get into Under the Skin a little bit. We teased this last week on the show that I wanted to kind of discuss maybe some of my negative feelings about a movie I absolutely adore, but really just wanted to bounce something off you and see where your head was at with
Sounds good.
The Skin. So we'll get to that again in the bonus content. If you want to seek out that audio, just go to filmspotting.net and click on apps.
Remember the movie Mobsters or If Looks Could Kill? Never mind Keanu Reeves. 1991 was all about Richard Grieco, Adam. We name our favorite films from that year in the Film Spotting Top 5 next.
Before that, though, a quick note about our music this week. It only seemed appropriate to play music from the year we're spending so much time talking about this week. It is Matthew Sweet's Girlfriend album, released in October of 91. It also has had a bit of a renaissance, at least for us here at Film Spotting, with myself and our producer, Sam, recently rediscovering this album completely separately from each other. We've both been listening to it pretty much nonstop. So top five girlfriend tracks, Josh. I know you're a fan of the album as well. Maybe that's a future top five at some point.
I wanna love somebody. Cause you need to get back in the arms of a good friend. And I need to get back in the arms of a girlfriend. I didn't know nobody, and then I saw you coming my way. You need to get back in the arms of a good friend. Oh, cause honey, believe me, she'd love to call you my girlfriend.
Hey there, Film Spotting original recipe listeners. This is Allison Wilmore from the Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit podcast. And in our latest episode, Matt Singer and I head across the pond to review the new Steve Coogan comedy, Alan Partridge.
And inspired by Alan Partridge, we're going to recommend some other British comedies you can stream or rent at home right now. And I promise I will only do my bad British accent 800 times. To listen or subscribe to the show, you can find us in iTunes or at filmspottingsvu.com.
Hi, this is Martin McDonough. You're listening to Film Spotting.
See, it's basic dog psychology. If you scare them and get them peeing down their leg, they submit. Yet if you project weakness, you draw aggression. That's how people get hurt. You see, fear causes hesitation. And hesitation will cause your worst fears to come true. So it's simple. You project strength to avoid conflict.
Peace through superior firepower.
You're listening to this very special Keanu Reeves-infused edition of Film Spotting with Josh Larson. I'm Adam Kempinar. Patrick Swayze there as Bodie in Catherine Bigelow's Point Break. My number one film of 1991, actually not, my number five probably, if it was really 1991, but it's not.
I am an FBI agent.
I know you are, Josh. I know you are. One of the memorable lines among many from that film, Point Break. And truly, if we were reflecting back on these films as we saw them, I was 15 years old in 1991. You were 16, 17?
Yeah, probably 16.
Yeah, so, you know, we probably didn't have the refined taste, Josh, that we have now, but Point Break would have been in my top five. Not going to make my top five now as we get back to our year-by-year countdowns. We started at 2004, the year before Film Spotting began. We've been counting back. We'd actually stopped at 93.
Yeah, I had people quite concerned about
this. I'm sure that we skipped 92.
We skipped 92.
Just pretended it didn't happen.
Uh-huh.
We'll get back to that at some point.
Okay.
But because
Good.
Of our sacred cow discussion of My Own Private Idaho, from 1991. We thought it was only appropriate that we'd share our five favorite films from that year. Josh, what is your number five?
Well, it was a really rich year, first of all. I mean, looking back at this, and I must have seen an awful lot of movies in 1991 for whatever reason, because only a handful of the significant titles, and My Own Private Idaho was one of them, are movies I hadn't seen before. So that was good. I felt like I'd done a decent amount of homework as far as that goes. My number five is Boys in the Hood, which I did see in 91. It was this out of nowhere blast from writer-director John Singleton. Singleton, he came directly out of a USC film program to write and direct this drama, which is about a promising African-American teen played by Cuba Gooding Jr., who's trying to balance family, friendship, schooling, and just plain old adolescence, really, in this gang-infested neighborhood of South Central Los Angeles. Boys in the Hood had a huge impact on the film scene when it came out. I mean, Singleton was nominated for Best Director by the Oscars, which made him the youngest ever and the first African-American for that honor. It was also selected for the 1991 Cannes Film Festival and took in $60 million that year, which is huge for this type of movie at that time. Now, 91 actually saw three significant dramas from African-American directors. We had Singleton's Boys, there was New Jack City from Mario Van Peebles, and then Straight Out of Brooklyn from Matty Rich, another low-budget effort. And these led to a wave of hood films in the 90s. You had Menace to Society, we got Juice, Fresh, Friday are a couple of those. What I think made Boys in the Hood distinctive was maybe the thoughtfulness that it brought to this story of trying to survive as a kid in a place where crime has become so integrated into the community. Boys really made this a matter of the heart and head, I think, as much as it was a matter of performing the right action or taking the right action to get out of these situations or to resolve these things. Mm-hmm. So really heady film, my number five film for 1991.
Why don't y'all take a look at that sign up there? See what it says? Cash for your home? You know what that is?
It's billboard.
What are y'all, Amos and Andy? Are you stepping and he's fetching? I'm talking about the message, what it stands for. It's called gentrification. It's what happens when the property value of a certain area is brought down. Huh? You listening?
Yeah.
To bring the property value down. They can buy the land at a lower price. Then they move all the people out, raise the property value, and sell it at a profit. Now, what we need to do is we need to keep everything in our neighborhood, everything, black.
It's an honorable mention for me. It is a really good film. My number three of 1991, if it was 1991.
You really put this together.
Oh, I gave some thought to it.
Okay.
As it is now, Josh, just an honorable mention. But it's always true of these lists to an extent that you're counting down the top five films of a given year as you remember them. Not necessarily the same thing as just an overall top five. If we were going to do this right, we would both spend about 3 weeks picking from our top 10 or 12 initial films from this list, and we'd rewatch all of them and reevaluate all of them.
For sure.
That just can't happen here as we're doing a weekly show. It especially becomes true, though, the further back we go in time, because they aren't as fresh in our memories necessarily, nor were they movies that either of us probably reviewed unless we've had a reason to revisit them. As we said, we were teenagers in 1991, so I wasn't writing reviews anyway for my student newspaper in high school at the time. I wasn't really thinking critically about these films. It's hard to go back, and I haven't seen a lot of these 91 films that stood out to me that were on my short list recently. So it was a tough list to put together. I always consider for these year-by-year countdowns the five films I can't live without that have to be salvaged for all time, though I'm going to immediately render that criterion completely worthless because Irene Jacob from The Double Life of Veronique, sorry, gone, been discarded for eternity in favor of Edward Furlong.
You're not here to kill me. I figured that part out for myself. So what's the deal?
My mission is to protect you.
My number five, Terminator 2.
Understandable.
Judgment Day. I was 15 that summer when it came out. I remember going to see that movie with a couple friends, seeing it on the big screen, and just being so charged up by that movie as we walked out. And I've caught up with just parts of it over the years. I've never sat down and watched the movie from start to finish, probably since that summer of 91, unfortunately. But it does always seem to hold up. And it's made many top five lists over the years, so I really don't have a whole lot more to say about it. But top five dream sequences, mother-son movies, time travel movies, it's been an honorable mention many times as well. I was a big fan of the first Terminator movie, and Schwarzenegger's T-800 was already such a great screen villain. I love that line from Reese in Terminator 1 where he says, "It can't be bargained with, it can't be reasoned with, it doesn't feel pity or remorse or fear, and it absolutely will not stop ever until you are dead." Well, Terminator 2 gives us that same thing, just a better model, that same lack of empathy and that objective, but even better and more efficient at killing. And there are great action sequences to this movie that don't feel dated at all, and characters who aren't just there to serve a function for the plot, but are conflicted and dramatic and evolve over the course of the movie. So for me, it still stands up, even though, as I said, I haven't had a chance to view it in its entirety. It stands up with Die Hard and some of those other movies from the mid to late 80s and early 90s as all-time great action films.
Yeah, it is. It does hold up. I've watched it more recently, and for reasons I'll get into a little later in my list. Another one that I can say for sure holds up, because I just rewatched it this weekend, is my number four, and that's Beauty and the Beast. The real reason this Disney film is on my list, though, is because my daughters and I recently took this Disney princess quiz. I don't know if you've done this, Adam. Tells you which Disney princess you would be.
Wow.
Based on
you still don't know me very well, do you, Josh?
The questions and your answers. I got Belle, so had to pick Beauty and the Beast.
Ah, Belle.
Good morning. I've come to return the book I borrowed.
Finished already?
Oh, I couldn't put it down. Have you got anything new?
Not since yesterday.
That's all right. I'll borrow this one.
That one? But you've read it twice.
Well, it's my favorite. Borrow places, daring sword fights, magic spells, a prince in disguise.
If you like it all that much, it's yours.
But, sir.
I insist.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Look, there she goes, the girl so peculiar.
Belle's key to this film, I think, how they've envisioned this character, especially in the whole Disney princess debate, you know, about how they may or may not serve as role models for girls. I don't think that's the only way you should look at Disney films, but I think it's an important way. And as far as Beauty and the Beast goes, I really appreciate how Belle's independence and her refusal to bow to conventional romance is established right in that amusing opening number where she sings about this longing for more than this provincial life. And that's juxtaposed in the same song with the buffoonish Gaston's cocksure plan to marry her. The animators throughout this movie are very sure to give her a sense of skeptical intelligence. Even when she's imprisoned by the Beast, she senses something more than his gruffness, isn't afraid to challenge his bravado. Later, after he does transform into the human prince, we get one of my favorite little details. She looks at him with this squinting eye and raised eyebrow as if she's not quite sure she believes what she's saying. And I also like to think that maybe she's lamenting the disappearance of the big hairy beast, because I know a lot of people prefer the Beast to that Kendall prince at the end. There's a lot more, though, to like about Beauty and the Beast beyond Belle. There are really some standout animation sequences, including that ballroom dance scene that's an early experiment in computer animation. The Beast himself is a wonderful character, even when he's prowling on all fours and they make him very animalistic. His eyes hint at this longing for his lost humanity. And there's also this undercurrent of a ghostly sadness to the film that recalls Jean Cocteau's 1946 Beauty and the Beast. So I appreciate that about it. This movie really did confirm Disney's return to relevance by being one of the best films of 1991.
Oh, sorry. I was just staring off into the distance thinking about you as a Disney princess. I sort of missed
quiz
that you were done there.
You should take it. Do it with Sophie sometime.
Yeah, that does highlight, though, a key difference between us in terms of, and we've talked about this before, our difference in appreciation for animated movies. Because I remember seeing Beauty and the Beast the year it came out, 1991. I remember really liking it. Probably my number 16 or 17 movie of 91.
Did you see that with your high school buddies right after T2? It was a double feature that night.
If only. If only. For my number four, I go back to that Terminator quote I just referenced a little bit ago about not being able to bargain with and reason with these killing machines. That applies to the villain from my number four pick, Hannibal Lecter, from Jonathan Demme's The Silence of the Lambs. It's actually what makes that character so disturbing and scary, I think, far more than the T-800 or the T-1000 later, that he doesn't just want to kill you. He probably wants to eat you or at least have some fun torturing you along the way. For me, that is more terrifying than Schwarzenegger or Robert Patrick in the Terminator films. And I'm not sure there's a more terrifying figure that's ever been on screen than Hannibal Lecter, as far as I'm concerned. And that's where Jonathan Demme and his use of point of view shots throughout his entire filmography really comes into play and is really effective in this film because it puts you in Clarice's position, looking into that glass box he's imprisoned in. And when he moves, when he comes closer to the glass, he's moving towards you. And I, as a viewer, want to actually physically back up. That introduction to him, that point of view camera, we see him first from Clarice's point of view. He's just standing still in the dead center of that box, and he's looking right at us. Just that, him standing there, is creepy enough. And the way his eyes light up when he says, Jack Crawford sent a trainee to me. He's just spinning with possibilities, what he can do with poor Clarice. And so far with Terminator 2 and Silence of the Lambs, I'm going with kind of conventional genre picks here, an action movie and here a serial killer film. But I'm as susceptible to those serial killer detective thrillers as anybody else. And I just think the combination of Demme's visual approach with Lecter's unique qualities as a villain, he's the last person in the world you ever want to spend any time with, and the person you could find yourself not wanting to pry yourself away from because the conversation would be so stimulating. That cat and mouse game between him and Jodie Foster is something I really appreciate about that film, in addition to the scares and the thrills along the way.
You want a story about seeing these films back in 91?
Yeah.
This will probably be somewhat of a confession. I don't think I've ever talked to my parents about this, but so Debbie and I are going on a date to see Silence of the Lambs, right? Going into the theater, 9:30 show. Parents are coming out of the Seven show or whatever it was. And they were, you know, they were fine with us going to movies. Not like they were restrictive at all. But for whatever reason, as creepy as this film was, this shows you the impact it had on people. They run into us in the parking lot and are like, you're not going to that movie.
Wow.
You guys go do something else. You're not going to that movie.
But like, you went.
We're like,
rebellious teens.
Okay, we'll go do something else. Get in the car. Wait for them to pull out of the parking lot, get out of the car, go to the movie.
Nice.
Because, yeah, that was my version of acting out, Adam.
Love it.
My number three, Terminator 2 Judgment Day. No shame in making this a top five film from 1991. It does hold up, as I've seen it recently. Might be Arnold Schwarzenegger's best movie. You'd probably say Predator, I know, from our list last week.
I wouldn't go quite that far,
no?
But it's number two.
Okay.
Or maybe right. Just behind The Running Man.
Okay. It could be James Cameron's best movie, though Aliens is probably definitely in the running
there.
But either way, it's an action movie landmark. I mean, it's inventive, it's propulsive, it's big, but never bludgeoning. It doesn't mistake chaos for excitement, which is what a lot of contemporary action movies do these days. And you're right, Cameron and screenwriter William Wisher Jr. had this great idea of turning Schwarzenegger into the good guy this time mm-hmm. around. And that just worked wonderfully in terms of reinventing that character, but using some of the same qualities, some of the same things that made the original Terminator so fascinating. And this advanced cyborg, the T-1000 that you get from Icy Robert Patrick, just an ingenious creation. I did name him as one of my top five movie robots last year. And I talked about how Patrick's performance, plus all the new CGI technology that enabled it, is probably the hallmark of this franchise for me.
He's a good looking boy. Do you mind if I keep this picture?
No, go on. There was a guy here this morning looking for him too.
Yeah, a big guy on a bike. Has that got something to do with this?
No. I wouldn't worry about him.
Now, going back to that action, I think one thing that stands out compared to what we get today frequently is how judicious Cameron is in doling it out and choosing when to lay it on heavy, when to back off, when to allow the suspense to build. Even Captain America, the Winter Soldier, which I liked quite a bit, in the end gives into one of these deadening climaxes mm-hmm. of endless fights and huge explosions, while T2 manages a finale that's not only in proportion with the rest of the film, but really somewhat poetic, too.
Absolutely. You're listening to Film Spotting. We're sharing our top five films of 1991. Go in the Wayback Machine with us here. My number three is The Fisher King, the movie that made me love Terry Gilliam as a director and also kind of ruined him for me, maybe, because it has all the anarchic spirit and visual flights of fancy you get with Gilliam and expect from him, but with a fairly conventional narrative, actually. And that through line, I guess, is what really keeps that movie together for me and really draws me to it. It is a redemption tale times two, and what's better than redemption when it feels earned, as it does for both of these characters, Jeff Bridges and Robin Williams. If you're not familiar with The Fisher King, Bridges plays a shock jock, and his flippant words on air that he really wasn't even thinking about one morning prompt a madman to go shoot up a restaurant. And then later, as he's dealing with the aftermath of this and trying to figure out kind of who he is and what he wants to be and what kind of person he is, Bridges' character meets Robin Williams' character, a homeless man on the street who has these visions of chasing the Holy Grail and fighting against the Red Knight. And this may be the last time, perhaps the only time, I didn't look at his entire list of films that Robin Williams and all that manic energy had been employed to good effect, but it is here.
I'm the janitor of God. I know.
Yeah. Hey, I know how you feel. I mean, they came to me about a year ago. I was sitting on the John, having one of those really satisfying bowel movements. You know those ones that border on mystical, where you're like... Oh! And there they were. Hundreds of the cutest little fat people floating right in front of me. It was wonderful. And then they spoke.
You know, there's a lot of standout sequences in The Fisher King for me, but that Grand Central Station one, I think everyone probably looks to justifiably when Williams is following the woman he's in love with, Amanda Plummer, and it turns into this symphony where everyone is dancing. And if you like Jeff Bridges, he's great here. He's charming and tortured at the same time, as he often is. And there's a little bit of crossover with this movie and the Williams character with My Own Private Idaho, Josh, in that the Williams character takes refuge. His name's Perry. He hides in these fantasies whenever his past is dredged up, whenever he's overloaded emotionally, just like Mike, the River Phoenix character in Idaho. Anytime things get a little too heavy for him and he really starts thinking about the past, he falls prey to that narcolepsy and just has to shut himself down. A little bit of that in Fisher King as well, but I love that film. It's my number three.
My number two is an homage, really, to Gilliam, an obvious one in a lot of ways, especially his brand of inventive insanity, so much that Gilliam lent his name to the marketing for it. It's Delicatessen, which was sold in the U.S. as Terry Gilliam Presents Delicatessen. This is a French film from co-directors Jean-Pierre Jeunet and Marc Caro. Jeunet would go on to make Amelie, and it's just this wonderfully odd little movie. It's set in a post-apocalyptic apartment building where the landlord is a cannibal butcher. But things are so desperate here that the neighbors don't really seem to mind. Despite all of this, there's a life-affirming sense of whimsy to the film that mostly characterizes it. It has a visual creativity that gets some of that across. There's certainly affection for its oddball characters, and it's a very communal film rather than rooted in one person or their story. You get a sense of what's going on in this entire apartment building, which is kind of cool. So take away the cannibalism, really, and it's not all that different from Amelie.
Well, you know how I am with whimsy. So Delicatessen, haven't seen it.
Haven't seen it.
Though I did really like Amelie, so there's really no excuse. And it is one among a handful of movies I really hope to catch up with before forming my list and just wasn't able to do it. Good pick. My number two is the film we discussed at length in the first segment of the show. It is Gus Van Sant's My Own Private Idaho. And if up to now my 5, 4, and 3 picks have all been essential as pieces of entertainment with artistic touches and flourishes that make them worthy of a top five list, this one I think is essential as a piece of art, as a film of its time that is also timeless and unlike any other film of that year or any other year. You think about how you can find relatives of even The Fisher King, but especially Terminator 2 and Silence of the Lambs in other films, in similar movies. I'm just not sure you can do that. As much as there are elements combined from different genres, as we mentioned in our review, the road movie, the Western, whatever, there is something about My Own Private Idaho to me that feels sometimes familiar, but the totality of it is a truly unique vision. It's my number two.
All right, you already stole Mind Thunder for my number one. Actually, it is The Fisher King. I was wild about this movie when it came out in 91, and I think I've seen it probably twice since then. And yeah, it's a magical experience. And you're right about Gilliam, the way you described. I think I'm probably a little more forgiving of some of his other stuff than you are, but I definitely can see and understand and often feel that same sort of resistance to the manic nature of his films. He's sort of like one of these all or nothing major league hitters in a lot of ways. You know, he always swings for the fences, and especially with the creative ambition of these projects, and he's just as likely to strike out as he is to hit a home run. For me, The Fisher King, it's his grand slam. It just all does come together. Maybe it is due to that script, which is by Richard LeGravenese, who did a lot of good work in the 90s. For me, though, with The Fisher King, the hectic nature that can overwhelm Gilliam's films, it pauses for a certain poignancy that feels new in some ways to his work. And you can feel it both in the visuals and in the performances of this film. The visions of the Red Knight that you talked about that Williams' character has, those are really haunting images that Gilliam provides. And both Bridges and Williams are very effective at humanizing what are extreme characters when you think about it. But the way they bring them to life and the way Williams' energy, as you talked about, is used, it is spot on. I mean, overall, I think there's a rooting in reality here that none of Gilliam's other films really have. And somehow doing that makes the flights of fancy that he takes all the more magical. So Fisher King, my best movie of 91.
Obviously a great pick. My number one, as we speak about creative ambition here, and as I was talking about art versus entertainment, how about the struggle at the core of this movie, the playwright turned screenwriter John Turturro in the Coen Brothers film Barton Fink. It's my number four, currently my number four Coen Brothers movie as I rank them on Letterboxd, and that's a tough list to crack.
Yes,
because
it is.
I like a lot of those films, but yeah, it's top five worthy as you consider all their films for me. Another one that's made a handful of top five lists over the years here. So I actually want to go to some comments from the critic Mike D'Angelo. In 2009, when A Serious Man came out, he did a feature for the AV Club called Scenic Routes, where he focused on a specific scene from Barton Fink. And he talks about the symbolism of the movie, how Joel and Ethan Coen put the movie's symbols right in the audience's face rather than, as Mike says, subtly deploy them in the margins or confine them to dream sequences. He says not only does that constitute a sort of respect, but it allows them to tackle real emotion, in this case loneliness and longing, without feeling exposed, as they can and inevitably do claim that it was just a giggle to them. And that really did strike a chord with me, because I think that blatant use of symbolism throughout Barton Fink is what can make the movie seem challenging and difficult on an initial viewing, but only more rewarding when you see it on repeated viewings. And it's another one like My Own Private Idaho that's a depressing movie at times, but so starkly and absurdly funny at times that it balances that out. And D'Angelo, it's funny, his inspiration to write that piece was that he was having a conversation with a couple other colleagues at Toronto, where they had just seen A Serious Man, and he wasn't as warm to that Coen Brothers film as they were. He just thought that they handled the same subject matter better in Barton Fink, and realized that they could have called Barton Fink A Serious Man, which is undoubtedly true, because part of that character's problem is his pretentiousness, how he views himself as more serious, as better than everyone around him in Hollywood, including the characters he writes, which is really a key flaw. For me, another one is Inside Llewyn Davis. When we talked about that movie, I couldn't help but think about that film riffing on that same type of Barton Fink character, where you've got a character there who's a folk musician, and he's got this real focus on being a professional, just as Barton Fink does, but they're both failures, and they're both artists with high art aspirations, but working within sort of low art slash popular medium. So this is a subject the Coen brothers keep going back to, for me, in really interesting ways. I like A Serious Man, but I like Inside Llewyn Davis and Barton Fink even more, and it's my number one.
I don't guess this means much to you.
Hell yeah, I could tell you some stories.
And that's the point, that we all have stories. The hopes and dreams of the common man are as noble as those of any king. The stuff of life. Why shouldn't it be the stuff of theater? And God damn it, why should that be such a hard pill to swallow? Don't call it new theater, Charlie. Call it real theater. Call it Owl Theater.
I can see you feel pretty strongly about it.
Well, I made that Letterboxd ranked list of the Coen brothers too, and Barton Fink was actually my number five, so very close to
yours.
So
we're close.
Probably then would have been number six on this list of 91 films.
All right, those are our top five films of 1991. Before we get to our honorable mentions, let's hear from a Film Spotting listener with his favorite films of the year.
Hello, Adam and Josh. This is Chuck Canzoneri from the Film Spotting Advisory Board, and I wanted to leave a message about two 1991 films that will probably go unmentioned. First is City of Hope, from filmmaker John Sayles, working with Oscar-winning cinematographer Robert Richardson. Sayles builds his fictional decaying city on a Robert Altman-sized canvas, splashing it with anger, passion, and working-class struggle. Richardson complements Sayles' dialogue like a waltz, as he deftly floats the camera between the characters. My other pick is Closetland, starring Madeline Stowe as a children's book author kidnapped by her unnamed government because they believe her stories are teaching kids subversion. Alan Rickman plays the government interrogator who must get her to confess. This allegorical fairy tale drips with fantastical style thanks to production and costume design by Iko Ishioka, but the style never takes away from Stowe and Rickman, who ground the film with strongly humanistic performances.
Thank you, Chuck. He does great work for us over at the Film Spotting Forum as a Film Spotting Advisory Board member. City of Hope, the John Sayles film, I voted for him in the Film Spotting poll over Jarmusch, and it's one I haven't seen. I've always wanted to and need to see. And then Closet Land with Madeline Stowe. Josh, for me, a film I've never even heard of.
Yeah, I don't remember that one.
Sounds fascinating based on Chuck's description. So thank you for those overlooked picks. Let's get then to some honorable mentions. We've both referenced a few, but what else jumped out for you from 91?
I remember Proof fondly, which is an Australian film from Jocelyn Moorhouse. It has an early performance by Russell Crowe. Also Spike Lee's Jungle Fever, though I haven't seen that one since. I don't think I've seen either of those since. Thelma and Louise is one I really feel like needs a revisit before I can get a grasp on. I mean, what does a 16, 17 year old kid, you know about the things Thelma and Louise is trying to get at? I remember enjoying the film, being fascinated by it, but I'd need to take another look. Jane Campion made An Angel at My Table that year. Hearts of Darkness, I thought this is one that would make your list for
very
sure.
Close.
The documentary about the making of Apocalypse Now, fantastic film. A couple more here. What About Bob? One of the grand Bill Murray performances. And Steven Soderbergh's Kafka. This was my first Soderbergh film that I had seen. If I recall correctly, we went down to the Music Box Theater for that one and really thought it was. I know a lot of people now think of it as an experiment in style. I haven't seen it since, but I loved it then.
No excuse considering I love Kafka's writings. And I love Steven Soderbergh. Haven't seen Kafka. It's one of Soderbergh's films I need to catch up with, sadly. For me, I did reference earlier The Double Life of Veronique, the Kieślowski film. It's a movie that was discussed as part of the Kieślowski Marathon here on the show. You're right, Hearts of Darkness, A Filmmaker's Apocalypse, definitely strongly considered. I'm a big fan of the David Mamet film, starring Joe Mantegna, as so many of his films are, Homicide. Speaking of Jarmusch, Night on Earth from 1991. One False Move, a great thriller from director Carl Franklin, an early Billy Bob Thornton screenplay and supporting turn there. And we talked about Linklater and his upcoming film Boyhood Slacker, his breakthrough film, also one of my favorites from 1991. The one movie that I can't really call an honorable mention, but if I was forming that top five films of 91 as it appeared in 91, I did have a real fondness for Kenneth Branagh and Emma Thompson in Dead Again.
Yes.
Loved that
movie. Oh, yeah. I thought that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's great.
Have not seen it since, though.
No. Those are, again, our favorite films from 1991. Send us your picks or any other comments about the show to feedback@filmspotting.net.
You can also leave us a voicemail, 312-264-0744, or find us on Twitter at Filmspotting and at facebook.com/filmspotting.
Out in wide release this weekend, the big movie, The Amazing Spider-Man 2. Josh says it's not so amazing. I have not seen it yet. Let us know what you think if you get a chance to see it. In limited release here in Chicago, I'll just read off a few titles here. The Bachelor Weekend, I believe that's playing at Facets. Decoding Annie Parker, Fading Gigolo, Friended to Death, Now in the Wings on a World Stage. And the two big releases, I think, the ones we're certainly the most curious about, Locke, the new film starring Tom Hardy. That's out. And Blue Ruin, which is a little revenge thriller that I've been trying to avoid all talk of it on social media. And it's been very hard because the gist I'm getting is the less you know about it, the better. But that's very hard when everyone keeps talking about it. So Blue Ruin is a movie that we're considering a few different things. But right now, it's probably what we're going to discuss on next week's show. It is available not only in select cities, but you can watch it on demand. I think you can get it via iTunes. So you can do your film spotting homework and be ready for next week's discussion. We'll also count down our top five most anticipated summer movies. And we probably won't get a chance to talk about these on the show, but I do want to plug one more time the upcoming Chicago Critics Film Festival. It takes place at the Music Box. It starts May 9th and it opens with, I believe it's the Friday night, with David Wayne's latest film, They Came Together, starring Paul Rudd and Amy Poehler. I'm hoping, Josh, we'll both be in attendance depending on our schedules.
Yeah, we're going to try.
Something I really do want to see. And if you want to learn more about that festival, the website is ChicagoCriticsFilmFestival.com.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths, and special thanks to everyone at Chicago Public Media. Chicago Public Media creates award-winning content about the issues that affect our community, our nation, and our world. More information is available at chicagopublicmedia.org. Our music this week, which Adam and I used to listen to on our Discmans, comes from Matthew Sweet. More information is at MatthewSweet.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Oh, the skipping on those things.
Oh, yeah. They were the worst. I used to have like one of those shock absorbers.
Yeah, for the car?
Yeah, on my dashboard.
And I rode my bike to school. So it's like every time you hit a curb.
No kidding.
You'd lose, you know, the song would have to start over again. I got through like one song the whole way.
So, Joe, that was for a redone ending there, obviously. And, hey, maybe that little exchange there is great bonus content or outtake. Knock yourself out. Everyone can hear how Josh rode his bike to school.